WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Dancers this Friday night at the Painted Bride in Philadelphia, and you can watch for them on television when their sitcom comes on the air. Thanks.
Thanks, Christiane. Christiane Vaillancourt is 91FM arts reporter, and you can hear her report this evening on 91 Report on the visit of the founders of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They came to Philadelphia today to check out the city to see if this should be the city to locate the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So Christiane will report on that visit this evening on 91 Report, which begins at 6:29, right after All Things Considered, here on WHYY-FM Philadelphia. Well, the time now is 4 o'clock, and you're listening to Fresh Air. And with me on Fresh Air is Nicholas Pileggi, a journalist who specializes in writing about crime. He had a great shot at getting an insider's view of the mafia when he was offered the chance to write the life story of Henry Hill, who had been in one of the New York mafia families since he was 12. Hill initiated the book idea after he and his family joined the Federal Witness Protection Program, and he needed money to pay his lawyers. The program was Hill's only crack at freedom. The feds wanted him, and the mob was out to kill him because he knew too much. Pileggi thought Hill would be a good source for insights into the mafia. He spent his life in it, knew how it worked, and was articulate with an outsider's eye for detail. Plus, he had a very impressive crime resume, ranging from stealing credit cards when he was 12 to organizing some pretty well-known jobs as an adult, like he was involved with the Lufthansa heist of $5 million in cash, and he was also behind the Boston College basketball point-shaving scheme. Pileggi's book about mobster Henry Hill is titled Wise Guy, Life in a Mafia Family. Wise Guy is published by Simon & Schuster, and it's number 10 on this Sunday's New York Times bestseller list. Writer Nicholas Pileggi has been a contributing editor to New York Magazine since it began in 1968. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
When you got this offer to write a book with, or, you know, based on the life of this mobster, how did you check each other out?
Well, he was easy to check out. He had more difficulty checking me. Yeah, he had more difficulty checking me out. He was easy to check out because he had been caught, and he was going to die. The men with whom he had been in operation his whole life were planning to kill him. He was one of a number of men had already, I mean, a number of his men had already been killed, and he was sort of he looked around and he was like the last little Indian in that fable. And he turned over everything to the FBI and to the United States Justice Department and the Organized Crime Strike Force. I have been covering this stuff for years. I had been looking into the organized crime and writing about it since 1956, to be perfectly honest. That was a long time. And this was an opportunity to see it from the inside, to actually talk to someone who was a member, not perhaps of an organized crime family, but an associate of that community and that world, and someone who had grown up in it. When I found out that he had actually started as an 11-year-old kid, I had no shame. I mean, it was Tom Sawyer grows up in the mob is what we were talking about. And he provided access that no outsiders can ever get. And it was a great opportunity for me to look into it and to learn. The way I was able to check up on Henry Hill was that everything he told me during the 3.5 years I debriefed him, he was also being debriefed by the FBI and the Justice Department. And indeed, it was a period of 3.5 years in his life where he relived everything he knew, everything he had grown up with. I guess it was a sort of intense psychiatric situation. However, in his case, it was a dangerous one because if he lied, he would break the agreement he had with the government. If he perjured himself or failed to tell them everything, they would break the agreement. He would be indicted for the charges which they had caught him. His immunity would be thrown away. He would no longer be immune, and he would be thrown back into a prison situation where he was guaranteed to be murdered. And so it was sort of the ideal situation for a journalist, where you really have somebody who, because you have the United States government for their own reasons, of course, mandating that this guy speak the truth, I was able to listen in, and it was just fascinating.
This is worse than an editor looking over your shoulder. You've got people who want to kill you if you're inaccurate. And he thought you checked out, I suppose.
Well, my meetings with him, I met him once or twice. What happens with these men is they live in such a narrow world. And they have code languages, and they know people by nicknames. Turns out that most of the people I talked to him about, he only knew their nicknames. Men he had known 20 years, he only knew their nicknames. He didn't know what their real names were. Oh, that's Eddie Wagon Wheels. That's Johnny Echoes. And he didn't know what their real name was. And eventually, of course, I then would have to go to the Bureau and the FBI or to affidavits, court papers, and find out who he was talking about. And he'd sometimes, oh, was that his name? I never knew that.
What is his stature in New York organized crime?
Well, he was not a big shot. He was a middle-level hustler. He was one of the guys in an organized crime group they have different jobs. His job was to hustle money. He was what they call an earner. He was a great guy at hustling money. He was hyperactive. According to his mother, he never stopped. He was totally active as a youngster. He would run through the house, slam doors, took care of rabbits, ran across the street and washed windows. He never stopped. If he ate, he was jumping up and down while he ate. Obviously in need of some kind of assistance, maybe a bucket full of Thorazine. But no matter how it worked out, that kind of activity and energy has always been with him. When he wound up in criminal activities, he was working just as industriously in those areas. And so he was working on 3, 4, 6 dozen things at the same time. He would have a loan shark operation going. He was doing bookmaking. He had a phony restaurant. He was running guns. The end of his life, he was in heroin and cocaine. He was planning hijackings. He was doing hijackings. He was also divvying up the money in different situations, all at the same time, and flying up to Boston every couple of weeks to be able to fix and bribe Boston College ball players in a point-shaving scam. He never stopped.
It's interesting how he got into organized crime because he wasn't born into it. It's not that his parents were involved with crime and he grew up in it. He got it through basically a job when he was a kid.
Well, it was just the opposite. His family were hardworking people. His father was Irish, an Irish immigrant actually, an electrical worker in the construction industry, and a hardworking man his whole life. His mother was a Sicilian woman, a hardworking woman from a hardworking family their whole lives. They were not gangsters. They were not part of any organized crime world. And he had lots of brothers and sisters. None of them have ever been involved in organized crime. Same house, same families, good providing parents. I mean, there weren't wealthy people, but there was always food in that house, and the children never were hungry and never were not nicely clothed and nor educated. Henry just fell in love with wise guys. He told me, he said, I was just a kid, and I would look out my window, and there was a cab stand across from where he lived, and it was a mob hangout. And he said, I'd see these guys get out of their cars, and they had these great big coats. And that's what he talked about. They had great big coats. And they'd show up there, and they always had a lot of money and jewelry and diamonds. And they were shown such great deference in the neighborhood. It should be said that Henry grew up in the Brownsville, East New York section of Brooklyn, which was the home of Murder Incorporated. It was a neighborhood in New York that is famous for producing gangsters. What West Point is to generals, East New York, Brownsville is to organized crime and to the mob. They just came from there. And they occupied a position in a working-class, hardworking neighborhood. They were the people with the power. It looked as though it worked. And to gullible kids like Henry, they looked up to the racketeers. And in the end, that's what he wanted to be.
How did Henry get into that circle?
Well, after school, he noticed they had the cab stand across the street. And every once in a while, there'd be a kid helping, going to get coffee, going and get beer, and that sort of stuff. And Henry asked his parents if he could get an after-school job. And his mother and father were both delighted with the idea. After all, he's a highly active kid. There were a lot of kids at home. The cab stand was right across the street. How bad could it be? And he went over there, and of course, he just fell in love with that world. And he went over to start running errands, and he was great. The wise guys loved him. He was cute. He was smart. He was a shrewd little kid, and he hustled. He would go. If they wanted him to get coffee, he'd go, and he'd get that coffee back before it was cool. If they needed beer, he'd get it back hot. And if they asked him to clean their cars, they'd give him $1 to clean the car. He'd clean it and polish it, and they'd never had their cars cleaned and polished so beautifully. And they realized the kid was a worker. He was really hustling with them. And at one point, one of the guys said, "Hey, Henry, come here." And he went over. He said, "See this envelope? Take this envelope to the pizza joint around the corner on Pickens Avenue." And around the corner he went. It was a numbers It was the records from the numbers game. And before you know it, by the time he was 12, he was hustling numbers. He was running the numbers. He was running errands past plainclothesmen. He began spotting plainclothesmen. He could spot a cop at 13. He knew who they were. He had all their license plates memorized. Before that, he just kept going. And not only numbers, he started doing other things. He started hanging around with the controllers of the numbers. He started counting up the controller ribbons. He was doing better with the numbers than he was in school.
When he was arrested the first time because he was found using a stolen credit card, there was this big initiation party afterwards, like he'd lost his virginity. And
well, that's what they said. And that, now that, you know, that is the kind of thing, if you write about, some people think, well, then after their first arrest, there is this ritualistic party where they all get together. That wasn't what it was at all. It was just a sort of spontaneous, happy experience for all of these guys, because all of these wise guys have all been arrested. And Henry hadn't been arrested. He was 16 years old. He got arrested for some stolen credit cards. He didn't tell his mother. He called the club. He didn't call the family, his mother and father. He called his gangster pals. They said, don't worry about it, Henry. You go to court, and we'll bring cop out Louis, the lawyer, in. Copped him out. And Henry turned around from the courtroom, and there were all of the guys in the back of the courtroom. They were all smiling. And he walked down, a freeman, actually paroled at this point, and they hugged him and they kissed him, and he said, you made it, you made it, you broke your cherry, was the term that was used. And it was this extraordinary, happy experience. It was as though he had graduated.
My guest is Nicholas Pileggi, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, which is called Wise Guy, Life in a Mafia Family. We're talking about the 1950s here, right? You had talked about how Henry, when he was a kid, really looked up to the mobsters in the neighborhood, and the mobsters had a lot of control over the neighborhood. What about the law-abiding neighborhood citizens? How did they treat the hoods in the neighborhood and the big-time mobsters who lived there?
With deference, because they were fearful. If you didn't have to have anything to do with them, you were a happy man in those neighborhoods. You walked to work, and you came home after work, and you carried your lunch to work, and you carried your pail back, and you went into your house, and you kept your door closed, and you had nothing to do with them. If you had nothing to do with them, you were safe, you were immune. If, unfortunately, you had to borrow money from them, if, unfortunately, you wound up working in a place that they owned, you were involved, and your life wasn't your own.
One of the ways that he really came into his own as far as his work and crime was when he got into the Army. You talk about all the little schemes he organized when he was in the Army selling things.
Yeah. Well, he's Sergeant Bilko. That's who he is. And even before he went into the Army, you've got to remember, he was cashing counterfeit 20s. He figured out, or one of the guys told him how to soak counterfeit 20 in coffee grounds and a little bit of water overnight, and then it looks like an old bill in the morning. He would cash those things. He was running the numbers. He had gotten a phony job in a construction union they had gotten for him. Then he split the check with the wise guys. Now he gets into the Army, and you would think, well, what's he going to do in the Army? Well, he said he loved the Army. It was like going away to camp. He had never learned to swim. He had never seen trees. He had never done any of those things. And here he was learning how to swim. It was wonderful. It was the Fresh Air Fund camp for Henry Hill. And then on top of that, it was a place you could make a lot of money. The hustler was always there. The wise guy is there. And he said, I couldn't believe it. He said, you know what they do in the Army? He said, they buy the same amount of meat and cook the same amount of steaks, say, on the weekends that they do in the week, during the week. Only on the weekends, you maybe have 10 soldiers in a camp instead of 250, because everybody's on weekend furlough. And he said, and there were all these steaks. They would cook them and throw them out, cook them every weekend and throw them out. And he said, that was crazy. So what I did, he said, he stole all the steaks on the weekends and sold them to the local restaurants. He gave the chef or whoever was in charge of the kitchen a few bucks, and he pocketed the rest. Now that he's got some money, he realized soldiers are always broke. Come payday, they need money. So he would lend them 6 for 5. He had a little loan sharking operation going on. And he said it was wonderful because I'd stand at the end of the pay line on payday, and as they came down the line, they'd pay me back the money. And so he was absolutely doing very well in the Army from the wise guy's point of view.
With that experience, he came home, and when he got home, he started doing the kind of operations that we all vaguely know about, but we don't really know how they work. Like, we know that there's all these truck heists and hot goods that are sold, whether it's televisions or now audio cassettes.
Yeah.
But I mean, who knows how they're really done. He did it. So you found out how these truck heists are organized.
Yeah, well, it was fascinating. I mean, it was just a revelation to me. I had no idea how it – I mean, we all know about hijackings, but I had no idea they were hijackings to order, number one. And number two, there's a whole scale of things that you prefer to hijack. I would think, for instance, what would you – if you had your chance of hijacking a truck, what would you do? Well, somebody would say, well, I'd just hijack a truck full of $15,000 Rolex watches or something. You know, that's something really expensive. That's not it at all. Henry said the most valuable thing in the world to hijack is a trailer truck full of lobster and shrimp. I said, what? And he said, absolutely. He said, they go like that. And he said, we have all these restaurants. We know these guys. Now we're talking about legitimate, ostensibly legitimate restaurant owners in New York City, in the New York City area, who will buy a trailer truck full of lobster and shrimp so quickly. And he said, they just buy the truck. They'll buy a quarter of a truck. They buy an eighth of a truck, a tenth of a truck, half a truck, whatever they need. And he said, and by dinner, the evidence has been eaten. There's no evidence left. Everybody has been eating. They just cooked it right then. The other thing they liked to steal were razor blades. They would steal these little packs of, you know, clip-on razor blades that people use. And the reason for their value is that they're so small and so expensive and so many and so easy to distribute and no serial numbers, and they sell them off to ostensibly legitimate businessmen, guys who might have a little discount store here, guy who might have the whole little wholesale business that supplies lots of drugstores, and that's where they would unload this stuff. So one of the revelations I had was that they don't operate in a vacuum. They don't steal a truckload of lobster and then go park on the corner of 17th Street and Walnut or something and say, will you come over here? Do you want to buy a lobster? You want to buy a frozen lobster? There's no way of doing that. They actually steal this stuff and then pass it on to ostensibly legitimate businessmen. They work in cahoots. The second thing that is fascinating is the way they knew what to steal. And it turns out they have friends and contacts and pals and people who owe them money, guys who are deeply in debt to gambling, guys who are deeply in debt to their bookmakers, have to serve as spotters. These are men who might work in an airport. They might work on the piers. They might work on the docks. They're in loading areas. They're in invoice areas. And they can spot the trucks. They can spot what's there. They tip the wise guys off, and they get a piece. They don't get a lot, but what they do is they can bring down their debt a little bit. It guarantees they're not going to get their kneecaps broken. And it's a way of surviving for them.
Now, some of the truck drivers are in on it, too, and they know they're going to be hijacked, and they play right along with it.
Absolutely.
How does that work?
Well, there's not much they can do. I mean, the truck driver knows that this truck, he's driving out of there with a truckload full of razor blades or shrimp or color televisions, and he's been given the signal. He knows that something's going to happen, and something does. He's along the road, and all of a sudden, two wise guys are there at a red light, and he just gets out. He knows. He gets out, and he gets into a tail car. They usually tail the truck to make sure there isn't a police car following. And he gets into the tail truck, and they'll take him to a motel. Quite often, they'll have some coffee. They'll take his wallet, and they'll take his license plate, his driver's license, and they'll know where he lives, and they'll know his name. And they'll say, if you remember what we look like, we know who you are, and we know you have a family, and you'll be sorry. And so when the police arrive, and they're not very cooperative. Well, I don't know. He'll say the guy was, he's 7 feet tall and he had green hair. I mean, they'll give a description that is totally opposite of what the men were. And they're safe. There's no way, the wise guys, that is, they're safe. They're gone. They've stolen the stuff. They've moved it into loading platforms and docks. That was the other thing. They have warehouses that are honest warehouses, not a mob warehouse with a mafia flag on the roof. It's a real warehouse where the truck next to it, the truck on either side of it, is unloading legitimate goods. But their truck, their little bay where they're unloading crooked goods, nobody knows. Things are not stamped. This load is crooked. These men are gangsters. But the guy who runs the crew, the hijacking gang, they know a guy who sort of maybe runs that warehouse or those loading platforms. And he gets a little bit too. So the money, the profits, are divided among legitimate people, quasi-legitimate people, who allow them to use their facilities to get these stolen goods into the mainstream of the American process.
Now, did the union play any part in this?
Yeah. At Kennedy Airport, one of the big complaints of the FBI and a lot of other people is that since a number of the locals out there are very heavily influenced by organized crime, when the airline says, wait a minute, every time this guy works, we lose a truck, a valuable truck. And last time we sent out two trucks, And we switch-swapped everything so that nobody would know unless he was really this guy. And it turns out he knew, and they stole the right truck. He is the spotter. We know he's the spotter. We're going to fire him. Well, if he is a member of a local that's organized crime, the organized crime shop steward, guy who was working in that union, will go to the employer and say, you can't fire him. He's a union member. You can't prove it. You can't prove anything. If you fire him, we're going to have a wildcat strike. So the employers quite often have to hire them back, or they'll take them out of that area and put them someplace where they can't spot that well. And that's what they have to do. But they know the guy is a spotter and they can't touch it because the union will cause problems for the trucker.
Now, another thing that a lot of us suspect, but we don't really know how it works, if it's really true, is that sometimes when cars are stolen, they're really going to be resold by organized crime. And he actually had a scam like that.
Oh, yeah. He had he was a very close friend of somebody who was extremely powerful and influential in Haiti, of all places. And what they would do is they would give kids $100 to steal cars. They would leave these cars on in parking lots. And then every once in a while, they would get all the cars together. They would get special invoices, bills of lading. The cars would be sent down with new – everything was forged. And there were people taken care of on the dock. It was all put on boats, shipped to Haiti. And the money, the profits from those cars were kept in Haiti. And then Henry would fly down every once in a while and get his money.
Could you tell how much of an alliance he and his cohorts had with the police?
Well, obviously not all police, but there was it was obvious, and he has spoken about it, the fact that lots of cops, not a lot, but many cops were on the take during his rise. He said that you had cops who you knew, and they would take care of you, and you would take care of them. For instance, when they were well known, you know, these guys were known to the cops. The cops knew who every one of these guys were, some of these cops. And some of them would give them a tough time and others wouldn't. But he talked lots of times about getting in brawls when they were going around trying to create paper locals or create locals within good unions to try to take over the union or take over the local. They were forever getting in brawls on picket lines and stuff. And the cops would come and break it up. And they would throw them in a car, and the other guys would get arrested. They'd be thrown in a car. And Henry said they never took us to the precinct. They'd drive us 3 or 4 blocks away and then tell us to get out. And those cops were taken care of.
My guest is Nicholas Pileggi, and we're discussing the subject of his new book. His book is called Wise Guy, Life in a Mafia Family, and it's based on extensive interviews that he did with Henry Hill after Hill joined the Witness Protection Program. Was he, during all this period, aligned with a larger New York family?
Oh, yes. He was associated. His mentor was a man by the name of Paul Vario, who was a capo in the Lucchese crime family. Lucchese crime family is named after Thomas Lucchese, Three Finger Brown, one of the five large organized crime families in New York City. Major power on the waterfront, major power at the airport, major power in the garment center.
So what did he owe to the family? You know, he wasn't very big in the family, but he was a...
Well, he's a worker. I mean, that's who they are. They're all workers. There aren't a lot of bosses. They're just... Everybody's a worker. And he was an earner, and he made a lot of money, and earned a lot of money for them. And he would pay tribute to his boss, who was Paul Vario. If he ever made a score, for instance, when they took $480,000 from Air France, when they stole $480,000, first thing he did was go and give $60,000 of it, $60,000 to Paul Vario. Paul didn't even know they were doing the robbery. He didn't have to know. Henry was out there hustling. You are on your own. It works quite differently than we have been led to believe by the movies and by often the FBI. They're really franchises. They're like franchisees. That's what it is. And only if they have a problem and a dispute among themselves do they take it to the next level. And then those men on the next level act as the judges in those disputes.
But if it turns out that he did a heist and didn't pay tribute, I guess that's when he'd really be in big trouble.
Then he's in trouble. And or if he decided to stick up a card game or to stick up a place that was associated with the families. Most of the murders, so many of the murders that he talked about in the book came about because young guys, tough young guys with guns, thought that they could go and stick up card games and stick up crap games that were run by organized crime families. And these young guys were often the sons of mob chiefs and mob bosses and mob lieutenants and capos. And the kid would go and do the robbery, and he would get away with it once, twice, three times. And the bosses would go and talk to his father. Will you stop your kid? He's going to get in trouble. We don't want to do things, but if he keeps this up, he's going to... And the fathers would go and talk to their sons and say, are you crazy? You can't do that. Go to another neighborhood. Stick up another card game. And the kids would go anyway. And eventually those kids were murdered. And they, when Henry talked about it, he says, if they liked the father, and the, they knew the family, they knew the father, they would always shoot the kid in the heart. And I said, why? He said, that way his face was okay for the funeral.
Oh,
so they could have an open casket. I mean, that was a sign of respect for his father. They wouldn't shoot the man's son in the face.
Well, they seem to have such a very hard to understand for an outsider view of murder. For instance, you know, after one of the really big jobs they did, and when they wanted to kill one of the people who knew about it, and I think had worked on it, they said, "Yeah, but if we knock him off, then his wife is going to really pester us."
Yes, well, he knew his wife.
Strange thing to say.
It's a guy by the name of Marty Krugman who had been the bookmaker and had been a little involved in this thing, and his wife was a smart woman. And she knew everybody. They, you know, these people hang around together. They don't have any friends outside of their immediate world. And every crew, Henry's little crew with Jimmy and Marty and Anthony and all these guys, that's the crew. And their wives all hang around together. And when and if, by some miracle, they go to vacation somewhere, they all go together. It's like this little block of people because they can't trust anyone else. And they don't move outside of their little worlds. They're very parochial, very narrow. We're not talking about Al Pacino traveling to the Dominican Republic or to Brazil for the weekend with Kathleen Turner. I mean, we're talking about really working class, hard guys from a low income socioeconomic world, even though they make a lot of money.
I found his relationship to his wife really interesting. When she married him, she had no idea that he was involved with the mafia. Yet when she found out, she didn't leave or anything, I guess.
We all know, I suppose we all know couples where we wonder, why does she stay with him and why does he stay with her? We all know that the other one of those people is not as good as the one we like, right? But we'll never know the answers to those things. I think one of the things that was interesting in Karen's case is that she found him thrilling for whatever reason. I'm sure there are a lot of other women who would have found him disgusting. But she, for whatever wiring she had between her ears, she found them thrilling. He turned her on. He was an exciting guy. And she tried to explain it to me. She said, well, you know, I mean, he could go places. He had money. He was an action guy. And there I was going out with little schmedricks. They were going to go and they were going to learn if they got, they were really smart. They're going to be accountants. And I saw the rest of my life with nothing. I mean, maybe if we were lucky, we'd go to Chinese food in the mall. I mean, when Henry, she said, I would go to the Copacabana. And when I got to the Copa, I had a ringside table. And people always looked at me and they thought, oh my, who is she? And it was thrilling to her. She was turned on by that. In addition, Henry was a tough piece of work. He's a good-looking guy. He certainly was when he was younger. And he's a dashing guy. And he was funny and he was humorous. And his pals were sort of noisy, funny guys. They were the center of attraction always, wherever they went. And they always had a lot of money and they were always treated very, very well.
He had a mistress eventually, and the impression I got was that Friday nights all the guys took out their mistresses and Saturday nights they take out the wives.
Smart impression. That's absolutely right. Friday night is the girlfriends. That's girlfriend night. They call it kumada night, but it's girlfriend night. The reason for that is Friday night they're still out making money, circulating, running around. And so you pick up somebody during the week or you get your girlfriend on Friday night and you run around. Now Saturday comes, that's the day at home with the family, right? That as much as they do stay home with their families, they're not at all as, you know, the ones that I've been writing about and found out about are not that devoted. They're not out there working on the grape arbor. But Saturday night is usually the night when all of the guys go out with their wives. And they try never to mix it up.
So the wives won't see the girlfriends.
So the wives don't see the girlfriends, and the girlfriends don't see the wives. And there's no, you know, that's to the girlfriends, the wives, oh, these terrible people, I don't know, someday I'll leave her, you know. And to the wives, they don't even know about the girlfriends, or not supposed to know.
He eventually got sentenced to 10 years in prison. But even in prison, he was able to do all this hustling. Before he even got into prison, he'd figured out ways of decreasing his sentence. What was his scheme for that?
Well, he had so many. But you see, that's it. A wise guy is a wise guy is a wise guy. They never stop. When he was convicted of extortion and a whole bunch of wise guy stuff, and federal prison, got 10 years. I said, wow, 10 years. He seemed too young to have spent 10 years in a federal prison. And it turns out he spent about 4.5 of those 10 years in prison. Well, the first thing he tells you is, listen, if you're convicted on me, you get 6 days off a month for every six. And if you take this course and go to a continuation school, you get 3 weeks off every year of your sentence. And if you, and by the time he had figured all the schemes out, all the sincere rehabilitation programs that all of the penologists, all of the sociologists, all of the people studying this had worked so hard and industriously to get rammed through the legislatures so that people in prison could rehabilitate themselves. Wise guys take those programs and distort them for their own purposes. So Henry not only was out in 4.5 years, but long before he got out, Henry was already into every furlough program, every notion of anything. There are religious furloughs where you can go away for a weekend of religious training, a very sane, a very sober thing. It allows you to get out of the prison and reacclimate yourself to the communities that you are going to be entering. We don't want people out of our prisons going right back into them. It allows you to perhaps have contacts with family and children to be able to reacquaint your family with you. It's a sane, very intelligent, sociologically studied course. Henry, of course, sees this and he says, great, get me a religious guy. So they got some phony guy who was a phony rabbi to write the letter to the prison. The prison is very responsive to religious letters. All of a sudden, Henry now is going off on religious studies on weekends. He gets in an Oldsmobile on a Friday afternoon. He even got Jimmy Burke to go on Jewish religious studies with him, if you can believe this. And they go off to Atlantic City is where they went. They'd get in a big Oldsmobile and drive, lickety-split, across Pennsylvania, to Atlantic City, where Henry said, you know, he just get up to the crap table, belly up to the crap table, and shoot craps until his ankle swole. And that's what he would do for his whole religious weekend, get back in the car Sunday night, and drive back to the prison. At the same time, his wife would fly down from New York. Other guys, wise guys, would come down, and their weekends in prison were spent on Atlantic City.
When he got to prison, there was actually a little welcoming committee there to meet him. What kind of inside connections did he have?
That's the other thing. If you're a wise guy, if crime is your life and people who are in crime are your closest friends, you're also going to know everybody who's in prison. This is a continuing saga that goes on, and it's all of your guys are in prison at one time or another. So when it's your turn to go to prison, you're going to know guys in prison. And they will have already paid off the crooked guards to make life cushy for them. And now you take up their role and you pay off the crooked guards who continue this operation. The stranger who gets arrested and convicted and goes to prison, who knows no one, who doesn't know how to pay off anybody, who doesn't even dare to try to pay off anybody, they're the people who do the tough time. When Henry got there, he was greeted by a bunch of cronies right there, right at the door. They then took him through the orientation period, and within 2 weeks, he was living in a dormitory setting outside the wall. Now, Lewisburg is a maximum security prison. A Warner Brothers wall is around the thing with these turrets and guys with guns. And there was Henry outside the wall in a dormitory setting, something like a Holiday Inn, with four wise guys in each room. He was in there with three other hoods. They had steaks, they had beer, they had wine, they had liquor, they had anisette after dinner, they had their own little coffee grinders. It was an extraordinary thing. And the guards, who should have been reporting this, of course, didn't. I said, you mean every guard was on the take? He said, oh, no, just a few. I said, well, then how'd you get away with it? I mean, were they the only ones? No, he said, you know, he said, if you pay a couple of guards and they take the money, the ones that don't take money, there are guards who will never take a penny from you. But you know what? He said, they won't report on the ones who do. And so they allow it to go on. By those guards not reporting the guards who take money and allow this situation to continue, those honest guards feel that they haven't taken a dime. They're honest. But they do allow this situation to continue.
It's hard for me to figure, though, that the warden wouldn't know that there are these guys living in a dormitory with steaks and coffee grinders.
It's a good question. I guess the warden should know, or if he didn't know, he should know. Occasionally, Henry said there would be a beef. There'd be a problem, something. And the guards would come through and take away all of the kitchen utensils. And they'd be without anything for a couple of days. But then, within no time, everything was brought back. So perhaps when anything was reported to higher authorities, say the warden, and they found out about it, there would be a cleanup. But the cleanup is never permanent.
But how do they get there in the first place? Because it's not the guards who decide what your location in the prison is going to be.
Oh, no, not at all. When Henry was finally convicted, and remember, he was convicted, and it took 2.5 years before he had to go to prison. I mean, he managed to work the appeals game to a degree. I mean, he appealed the decision, and that went off for a long way. Then he was on an appeal bond, which means he was free while his case was being appealed. So it was 2.5 years from the day of his conviction when the judge said 10 years in a federal penitentiary, 2.5 years before he stepped into that prison. And when he stepped into Lewisburg, I said, how'd you get to Lewisburg? He said, I took care of the guy at the federal house of detention. I gave the guy $50, and he put me on Lewisburg. And I said, why Lewisburg? He said, well, it's closer to home. Atlanta would have been too far away. That cost $50. It cost him, he said, when he was in prison, it cost him $500 a week in bribery alone.
And in order to make that money, he started selling drugs in prison.
You got it. Started selling drugs in prison. He started bookmaking in prison. He started loan sharking in prison. He started doing everything he ever did.
How did he get the drugs in to sell them?
They were all smuggled into him by other organized crime people, including his wife smuggled drugs in for a while. She would put the drugs into she went out and got an oversized brassiere and hip boots, or, you know, high knee boots, several sizes too large, and she began stuffing the drugs into those boots. The search when you go in for your visits are very cursory. There is no major thing. You go through the kind of metal detector that you have in the airport, but that's all they do. And they get to know these women week after week after week, and you can just walk in with it. There is no major effort to keep it from being in.
Clearly, if you really know what you're doing and you've got organized crime connections, prison is neither going to serve as a punishment, great punishment, deterrence, or rehabilitation. You're just going to find a way to subvert the whole thing
exactly. And
still be comfortable.
Exactly.
So I guess the system isn't working that effectively.
Not with them. I mean, they'll figure a way of subverting every system. That's what they're about.
My guest is journalist Nicholas Pileggi, and we're discussing the subject of his new book. It's called Wise Guy, Life in a Mafia Family. When he got out, he still was selling drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was still taboo in parts of organized crime.
It was in his crew, in his organized crime, the family he was associated with, namely the Paul Vario faction of the Lucchese family. Paul Vario just hated drugs, didn't want them anywhere around him, didn't want anyone dealing drugs near him. He knew, I don't know whether this was a moral issue or was ethical or was just business, but Henry told me that Paul Vario you were forbidden to deal in drugs if you were with him. The reason Vario said was that drugs were corruptors. Drugs, not only, he said, you wind up in drugs, you're going to wind up having a cop for a partner. There's so much corruption in the operation. You wind up with cops for partners, and I don't want to be near you. It's a world of total betrayal. If the world of the Henry Hills and the wise guys and organized crime is filled with betrayal, the world of the drug dealers is betrayal to the 10th power. There is no one there who isn't squealing on someone else all the time. And I think Vario was worried about that. And so he felt they had enough going with gambling and with loan sharking and with racketeers of all kinds that he didn't need the drug money. He was doing very nicely, thank you. Unfortunately for Vario, the guys under him, the Henry Hills, the Anthony Stabiles, the Angelo Seppis, those guys, they weren't doing as well as Paul Vario. They weren't doing as well as their superiors. And so for them, the extra money and they could get from drugs was extraordinary. And they went into drugs. And they kept it. They had to hide not only from the cops, but they had to hide from the organized crime bosses.
Did the bosses find out?
On occasion they did, and on occasion you'd find dead people. So I mean, they literally killed people. If they were caught in drugs, they would be killed.
It seems that after Henry Hill got out of prison, he got much more ambitious and took on some really bigger jobs than the jobs he'd taken on before.
Well, he did. He came out of prison. One thing he told me, he said, you know, he said, I'd never smoked a marijuana cigarette until I went to prison. He said, I learned about drugs in prison. He said, I never did anything. He said, I was around. I did a lot of bad things, but I never was into drugs. But in prison, the only way he could get money to pay off the guards was to smuggle drugs into the prison. People wanted pot. People wanted coke. And so he got into the drug world while under the aegis of the United States Bureau of Prisons. When he got out, he found it was one of the only ways he had available to him to make a lot of money quickly.
The porn shaving scheme that he cooked up really shook college basketball. That was a pretty big story.
Oh, and it was.
One of the players was sentenced to 10 years.
Yes, one of them was.
How was this? Was this done a lot?
Well, I don't know whether it's done a lot. It was certainly done in his case. What happened was that again he was working off. He'd come out of prison, and one of the men who was selling drugs for him in prison, or was smuggling the drugs into him at this point, was lived in Pittsburgh. And the guy owed him $15,000, and Henry was going to take that money and go back into operation. When he got to the guy's house to pick up the money, now Henry isn't out of jail 24 hours, he's going to pick up his $15,000. The guy said, "I don't have any money. All I've got is a garage full of grass, marijuana." And Henry said, "What am I going to do with that?" He said, "Well, you know, take it. Take a couple of suitcases. Go get a suitcase. Get it. I'll give you all you want that'll be $15,000 worth. You'll be amazed. It'll be easy to get rid of." He said, "What am I going to do?" Henry had to get some kind of money. So he gets a suitcase full of dope, full of marijuana, and then gets on a Greyhound bus and goes back to New York. He was afraid to take the plane because he didn't know whether anybody would be able to spot the grass, whether a dog would sniff it. He didn't know anything about drugs on the outside at that point. When he got back to New York, he's got this suitcase full of grass. He can't go to Paul Verrio and his usual crime people and say, "Listen, I got a suitcase full of grass." They would have ostracized him, killed him, beaten him up, who knows? So he had to go behind their back and find other crime people who were dealing in drugs. And he managed to unload the suitcase. And he got something like $25,000. It was some special stuff. And he said, "Oh, boy, this is great. What am I knocking myself out for?" And from then on, drugs became a major, first grass, then he went into chemicals, and then into cocaine, into heroin. Drugs became a major source of revenue for him. At the same time he was dealing the drugs, he's talking to this guy in Pittsburgh who was his supplier, and he said, "You know, I know this guy, grew up with him. He used to be a ball player, and in fact, now he's a ball player at Boston College, you know, and he's a shrewd guy." And he said, "Well, maybe we can reach him. Maybe we can reach him." And there was a meeting, and Henry said, "Listen, I'm a sports fan, you're a sports fan, you're a college guy, rah, rah, rah. Look, I'm not asking you to throw a game. That's the last thing. I don't believe in that. But you don't have to win by so much. I mean, we got a point spread of 6. You don't win by 6. That way I can bet the game, and I win, and you win the game because you win the game. You just don't win by so much, and I will bet on the number." And he managed, according to the federal court, where trials took place and people were convicted, to convince one of the players, and then that player convinced a couple of other players to shave points. And the point-shaving scandal at Boston College was a result of that. But here you see Henry just casually getting involved in a point-shaving scandal in a school. Ed McDonald, who's the United States Task Force boss in New York, who actually went to Boston College and played on the Boston College team, said Henry is the kind of guy, he hasn't rooted for anything but a point spread in his whole life. That's what he roots for.
It's amazing how creative the guy is.
Well, he's not alone. That's more typical of who they are, I think. That's who they are.
And then the other really big heist he did was he was one of the people behind the Lufthansa heist, in which they got $5
million? $5.8 million in cash, not a penny ever recovered, the largest successful cash robbery in American history.
And this was through getting the cargo from a plane.
Again, it was one of these cargo handlers out at Lufthansa who owed a bookmaker who worked for Henry Hill about $80,000. From debts. This is a poor cargo handler who had a junky habit as a gambler. He used to bet $500 on a game on a $300 a week salary check. And he, to get the wise guys off his back, to get that debt absolved, he knew about this money being transported to this country from Europe, and he told them about it. They went and they held the place up, and they got it.
That's where things started falling apart for him.
It did. It was so much money. It was such an unbelievable amount of money that instead of it freeing the group, and there were about a dozen men involved in that, when every one of the men began asking for his share, they began disappearing, or they would wind up dead. And the other guys were never sure why they were dead. You don't know, because everybody's in so many other things. And if one guy died, the rumor would get around, well, you know, it was a dirty drug deal. He had a drug deal in Newark that really went down bad, and they had to whack him, and he's whacked. Nobody knew why everybody was disappearing. Nobody wanted to relate it to the fact that we were getting murdered whenever we asked for our money. Henry knew. Henry said, "I sensed it. I knew it. I knew these guys. I knew Jimmy. I knew what they were up to. And I knew when you ask for your money, you're dead." And that's what happened. About 10 people, 10 of the participants, 10 of the guys who were involved intimately with that robbery, who actually went in with the guns and held the place up, were all murdered. Henry was one of the last not to be murdered. And when he was arrested in the drug case, he realized his days on the street were over. Even if Henry didn't talk, you remember he was convicted of 10 years, never talked, never did anything. Even if he didn't talk, they were going to kill him because he might have talked. And that was it for Henry, and that's when he turned as a government witness.
So what were his choices? He could have spent a lot of time in prison. Do you think they would have gotten him in prison?
Oh, he would have never gone. I mean, they would have never gotten to prison. They would have killed him. Only on the possibility that he might have talked. That would have been enough to sign his death warrant. They knew he was vulnerable. And being vulnerable is all you have to be. Then you're dead.
So it was shortly after that that he contacted you to write the book.
He contacted the United States Attorney's Office and was in the program. When I met him, he was already a witness, a federal witness.
So they took his wife, his kids, and himself into the program. And
yes.
Obviously you can't tell us anything about like where he is or anything.
Well, I don't know. But, I mean, the program is such that you don't know.
How much were you allowed to find out?
Nothing. I can't find out anything. I don't want to find out
anything. Yeah, it's really better for you that way. You wouldn't be very safe if
you knew. But you don't know. Even the U.S. attorneys who are prosecuting the cases, I mean, who are working with Henry on a daily basis, yeah, FBI men, they don't know where he is. The entire federal witness program is handled by United States Marshals, who, of course, are part of the Justice Department, and they never talk. I mean, they are stone-faced. They don't smile. You get to see the same guys year after year. I spent 3.5 years with Henry. I got to see these guys age just like I did, and they never said a word. They would just take him and take him downstairs in the U.S. Courthouse, and he would disappear. And the next time you saw him, they'd take him up the stairs again.
So that's where you met with him in the courthouse?
I would meet with him in courthouse, United States courthouses, in prisons and jails where he was temporarily being housed during transit situations where he's being transferred. That sort of way. That's the way we did it.
For those years, were you not able to tell anybody who you were meeting with?
No, I didn't. I told as few people as possible.
Yeah, I guess you wouldn't want mobsters showing up hoping
well,
to
and,
get
and he was also testifying
him.
In cases. And, I mean, I didn't particularly have anything to add to those cases. I could have been used, manipulated. I just didn't want to have anything to do with it. I thought there was nothing for me to tell about anyway.
Part of why he wanted to have this book written is so that he could, through a percentage of the royalties, get enough money to pay his lawyer. Have you ever thought that maybe he really embellished his life a lot so that he could
that was one of my first thoughts
when bestseller?
That was one of my first thoughts when I had to deal with him. But what the book is, it's while it's got Henry's story, everything he's told me, he was also telling the FBI at the same time. He was being debriefed for all of these cases at the same time. These cases went to trial. He testified in these cases. In these cases, if he would have lied in any one of these cases, he would have committed perjury. The entire agreement with the United States government would be null and void. He would go back to as a convict, and he would have been dead. So it was in his interest to keep telling the truth to the FBI, and I found out exactly what it was he was telling them, and then I would ask him other questions. In addition, there were affidavits, there were separate court statements, there were court documents, there were tape recordings made when he didn't even know he was going to get arrested. And there were also people he knew who I was able to gain access to. In addition, I, of course, talked to members of his family. I got to his wife. I talked to his kids. I talked to his mother. I talked to guys he grew up with. So it was pretty well covered. I mean, I've been doing this too long to spend 3.5 years on a fairy tale. I mean, that wasn't what I was after. And the kinds of things he came up with were so revealing, so different than I had assumed. And it was just, you couldn't make it up. In other words, you couldn't make up. The stories he told me, I could not make up if I was sitting in Malibu writing for the movies.
He's in the Federal Witness Protection Program now. And do you have any idea what kind of house he has, what kind of job he has or salary that he lives on?
What they've said now is that, you see, when you go into the witness program, everything you have, say you're swooped up today, you might own a house, and the house might be worth $100,000 or $50,000 or $10,000 or whatever. Well, they don't take that from you. You have the right to sell that house. And so now you sell that house and you go to a new environment, wherever, Minnesota, New Mexico, Canada, wherever, and you've got that money from the sale of a house. All of that is done through the government and through lawyers and blinds, so you can't find it. But meanwhile, eventually that money comes to you and you buy another house. So Henry had some money, and where he now lives, according to the Justice Department, this is the best I can get, is he lives in a house that's worth about $150,000. I have talked to him about, that it's a nice, he said, it's a colonial, nice little colonial house. He's happy with it. He lives in a neighborhood that's crime-free. He's able to tell me that. He said that his kids are going off to school. They're healthy, nice kids. And he's living a marginally normal life. What he's doing and how he's acting and whether he's still a wise guy wherever he is, I don't know. If he gets arrested and falls into his old ways, he's in severe trouble.
It's funny, he tells you that he really misses the life and he just feels like a schnook. You know, he's just living like any old schnook now.
What he's saying to us is that I'm living like you. That's what he's saying. And he's calling me a schnook and he's calling you a schnook. He's calling everyone who lives a decent, honest, hardworking life a schnook. But that's his mentality, and that's what he was twisted at 11, and he's twisted his whole life. And that's what these guys are. They're all a little, there's something missing up there. All of the wires didn't connect.
I love something you said to me before. You said that when you heard him talk about his life in organized crime, it sounded like the Cramdens. It sounded like the Honeymooners more than it sounded like the Godfather.
Yes, that is what it is. And it turns out even the bosses on his level, and his immediate bosses, and even the big bosses, they are not these totally sophisticated Robert Duvall, Al Pacino, brilliant people. They are really working class people for the most part, with very little education, very aggressive, very highly charged, and he's sort of like a lot of the guys around them reminded me of Ralph Cramden and Ed Norton on The Honeymooners. I mean, that's who they are. They buffalo people, and they have all kinds of schemes that don't work, and sometimes they work, but they're also violent, and they're also very dangerous.
Do you see more organized crime around you after doing these long interviews with Henry Hill? Do you suspect more restaurants as really being run by the mafia, or more goods that you're buying as actually being hot stuff off of heisted trucks?
No, I know what you mean. I don't see it as an overwhelming thing. I mean, I don't think the odds of buying a stolen television set from a legitimate business are very remote. I mean, they're not that many of them. They're not doing that much. They're stealing millions and millions and millions of dollars of stuff, and it's going to different markets. And it might be going to a lot of crooked businessmen who are then selling it maybe in the South. Maybe they put it in a truck and send it to now South Carolina. Maybe send it to Arizona. Maybe sell it some other part of the country. But it is not overpowering. I don't think it is taking over the country.
What about places where there are legalized gambling, places where there's legalized gambling like Atlantic City, for instance? Do you think that there's any way of keeping organized crime out of that, given the creativity and resources
The
mobsters?
I think there are areas where you can keep them out. I think they're obviously out of the casinos. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't have a piece of casinos. They don't have secret ownerships. They don't have any of that nonsense. Those days are over for them. But it's hard to keep them out of muscling into a legitimate union. Say there's a legitimate union in Atlantic City representing hardworking people. Maybe they're commissary workers. Maybe they're hotel workers. Maybe they're roofers. Maybe whatever. All of a sudden, another local pops up, and these guys are now wanting to represent you. And people's noses are broken, and there are people injured. It's hard to keep them out. They will bull their way in. The cops can come and arrest a couple of them. There will be new guys bullying their way in. It's a constant battle with them if they want what you've got. I think the point has to be made that they don't work in a vacuum, that they can't take over a union where they don't think they will also have the complicity of some of the manufacturers and some of the owners of the businesses with whom they will be dealing.
Why is organized crime so hard to crack? And, you know, so many times mobsters are arrested on tax fraud charges instead of all the crimes that they've really committed through their lives.
Well, they seem to be very well insulated from blame. It's never the boss who did all this stuff. It was always Henry who was out there. Henry's neck was on the line. And the kinds of stuff they do, for the most part, is in collusion with people. When I said they don't operate in a vacuum, they don't. When they steal stuff on the waterfront or on the piers, they're selling it to happy, satisfied businessmen who are taking the stolen goods and incorporating it into their business system. When they steal the shrimp and the lobsters, they're selling it to restaurants that are not mob restaurants. They're regular restaurants. They're restaurants owned by legitimate people who are just availing themselves of the organized crime service of cheap goods. And so between that and the fact that they're very terrifying, that it's very difficult to get witnesses to come forward. And when the witnesses do come forward, quite often they don't live long enough to testify in the end, and they're threatened and abused. You find that they have managed to insulate themselves very nicely.
Do you think that the Federal Witness Protection Program is effective?
Yes, it is. It's extremely effective. It's effective not as a rehabilitation program. That's not what it's supposed to be. But it's effective in the fact that it can protect a witness who is going to appear in a federal case and testify against guys who were worse than he. I mean, what it essentially does is they find a lieutenant in the Wehrmacht, and they give him immunity for all his crimes, but he has to testify against Hitler, Goebbels, Goering, and Himmler. Well worth it as far as the United States government is concerned. I know there are people who are going to say that lieutenant is just as guilty morally, ethically, and in his soul as the heads, but the government has felt that otherwise everybody goes free. This way, at least, the top guys go in.
How many people did Henry Hill help to convict?
He helped to convict at least a dozen. Paul Vario, Jimmy Burke, all of the guys he grew up with, all of them. A lot of them he was not able to convict because they were murdered before they ever got to trial.
You've mentioned a few times that the mafia movies that are so popular are really nothing like what organized crime really is like. What are some of the other differences between the way it's usually portrayed in films
and the way you've actually seen it? There's a romance about the real world. There's a notion that there's this code of honor among a lot of them. It's not that I don't see too much of that. There's also the notion of they're going to take care of the wives when the husbands go to jail. Well, Karen didn't find that to be true, nor did the other wives. When your husband goes to jail, you are prey. A lot of the guys who were friends and pals started going around. They put the arm on the wives. They try to shake the wives down. Karen had a restaurant. Henry had a restaurant just before he went away for 10 years, and she sold all of the fixtures and sold all of the goods. And one of the wise guys, a partner of Henry's, said, "I'll take care of it and I'll sell it for you. I can get good money for you." So she gave it to him. He did it. He never gave her the money. He refused. When she went to somebody who had worked for Henry and said, "Listen, we're in trouble. We helped you a lot. Henry took care of you for many, many years. I'm going to need some money to get me through this time." And he said, "You need money? Why don't you take your kids and go to the police station? They'll put you on welfare." That's the way they treated the women who were victimized in this situation. So that's a long way from The Godfather. That's a long way from Marlon Brando and his postulating.
I really never heard the term wise guy used to describe a gangster until your book.
Yeah, I never heard it, or you never thought of it as a term, but that's what they used to call each other. Those hanging around, they say, "What do you do?" "Oh, yeah, he's a wise guy. He's all right. He's a wise guy." They use that term. They don't say, "I'm a racketeer," or "I'm a gangster." They say, "No, I'm a wise guy. He's a wise guy."
You've been reporting on organized crime since the 1950s. Obviously, you're pretty absorbed in the subject. What is so fascinating to you about the mob?
It is a fascinating subject. It's the ultimate expression, perhaps, of the free enterprise system. I don't know. I mean, it's taken it to a point where only the teeth show. But it tells a lot about a society. It tells a lot about the country. It's a fascinating world. It's small. I don't look at it basically as a cops and robbers case. I don't look at the whole subject that way. I really look at it as sort of an anthropological study. And that, in a sense, is what I wanted to do with this book, is to study them the way Margaret Mead studied the Samoans, because they are a strange, bizarre criminal subculture. Happily, they do not have the effect upon us the media makes us think they do, but they are still fascinating nonetheless.
Thank you very much for talking with us about some of the research you've done into the mob. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Nicholas Pileggi. He's a journalist who's been reporting on organized crime since the 1950s. His new book is called Wise Guy, Life in a Mafia Family, and it's based on years of interviews that he did with Henry Hill, who was a kind of middle-level mobster in New York. And Hill was given immunity in the Federal Witness Protection Program. And while he's been in that program, he spoke with Nicholas Pileggi about his life. The book, again, is called Wise Guy, Life in a Mafia Family, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. It's 5:03. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Thank you. A couple traffic problems. Northbound I-95 is jammed in central Philadelphia right around Penn's Landing. Then it's at a standstill from Coppin all the way through the Woodhaven exit due to a tractor-trailer accident still off the side of the road. That accident occurred yesterday around 2 o'clock. Accident at Wissahickon and Queen Lane. Traffic on the Schuylkill Expressway jammed westbound from Montgomery Drive all the way through Belmont. That's taking about 40 minutes. Eastbound traffic's tied up approaching the Glenwood on-ramp down through Route 1. I'm Bob Murphy, reporting Shadow Traffic on WHYY 91 FM.
That Shadow Traffic report was funded by Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by Virginia Foster Dyer, who's written a memoir about her work in the civil rights struggle during the first part of the century. And at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by singer Taj Mahal. This Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be white South African playwright Ethel Fugard, whose plays include Master Harold and the Boys, The Blood Knot, and Sizwe Banzwe is Dead. And by the way, joining us this Monday at 4 o'clock on Fresh Air for a return visit will be exiled South African poet Dennis Brutus. So that's coming up Monday at 4 o'clock. I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Contributing today, Christiane Vaillancourt. Production assistance from Mildred Moffat. The engineers for today's show were Ron Barron and Audrey Voblaitis. Amy Salad is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller co-produces the show. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Susan Stambrew.
This is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
Why did Secretary Odell fire me one working day after the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation announced that it had raised $233 million to date and had cracked the original goal of $230 million? I honestly don't know.
Removed from his job as head of the Commission to Restore the Statue of Liberty, tonight on All Things Considered, Lee Iacocca defends himself.
A busy day for Mr. Iacocca. His company, the Chrysler Corporation, announces it's slashing prices on small cars.
Also these stories. In the Philippines, thousands attend the funeral of a murdered Aquino campaign worker.
Wolves making a comeback out west.
And some pre-Valentine's Day advice on how to marry the man of your choice.
But more now this news.
This is Lori Wampenschmidt. In the Philippines, a campaign organizer for Corazon Aquino was murdered today as Aquino was attending the funeral of a supporter slain earlier this week.